Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We are trying to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus, trying to take the headline news of the day and become equipped to enter into the conversations of the day as people who know what we're talking about and can talk about it in a way that actually glorifies God and edifies people. So I'm really excited to have here in the opening segment today my friend and colleague in ministry, Dan Darling. He serves as the communications director for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. He's also a pastor and an author. He has a new book coming out next week called The Dignity Revolution. But today, at USA Today, he has an opinion piece posted. It's entitled, On the Brink of a Post-Roe World, Pro-Life Movement Needs a Future Beyond Abortion. Dan Darling, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be here with you, Carmen.
So I love the way you have reframed the conversation, the pro-life conversation. I contend needs to be about more than abortion. It needs to be about life. So talk with us about getting beyond abortion as the way that people think about the pro-life issue and getting to the place where what we think about is actually human dignity.
And to be clear, when we say getting beyond abortion, we're not saying moving past it. We're saying, you know, in fact, I make the argument in this piece and in my book that the pro-life movement has given us a moral vocabulary for an unjust world. Because the pro-life movement, more than any movement in our society, has consistently made the argument that the most vulnerable among us, the most defenseless, are humans. They're full humans. And so for me, you know, it was my entrance into politics at a very young age. Why I wanted to get involved was because I really cared about and saw the humanity of what the rest of society was saying was disposable or throwaway. And so I'm hoping and praying for a day that abortion is not just illegal, but it's unthinkable. You know, that we'll look back and say, you know, I can't believe we had a society that did this. But I do think to be people of the gospel, to be people that care, that love our neighbors as ourselves, as Jesus told us to do, the people that believe that every human is created in the image of God, that we have to fight assaults on humanity wherever they're found. So whether it's against the unborn, whether it's against the elderly through neglect, through euthanasia, through all sorts of things, or anything in between. And even in the vocabulary that we use about people groups, that we use vocabulary that that recognizes the full dignity they have given by God.
So let's talk about some of those words. When you suggest that it's given us a moral vocabulary, but give us some examples.
So when we're talking about being pro-life, we're saying that every human being is created in the image of God. And, you know, human dignity is one of the best gifts that Christianity gives to the world. And so it says that humans have unique intrinsic value above the rest of the natural world, because God has stamped them with his image, that he has knit and crafted every human in the womb. And so this idea that there's no disposable humans, there's no people that are not valuable, regardless of what they've done, regardless of where they've come from, regardless of their perceived utility to society, that they have value. That is a powerful, powerful statement, and I think it could really change the way we see the world.
Okay, so there is so much to celebrate in terms of the pro-life movement, mm-hmm. and there's so much conversation related to the, I mean, I think that even just a few years ago, it might have been beyond people's hope mm-hmm. that Roe v. Wade might be overturned. Now there's at least conversation that it's possible that mm-hmm. maybe it would at least return to being a states' rights mm-hmm. question. When you're having conversations with people, both on the local and the national level, about this subject, what are some of their concerns?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, number one, I think there is a chance that Roe v. Wade could be overturned. I think so. We should applaud. It would obviously go back to the states, and there'd be have to be a real work at the state level to ban abortion. When I'm talking with people, one of the best arguments the pro-life people have is you know, there's an there's an innate sense in all of us that the unborn baby is a person, right? So like when Beyonce a couple years ago announced that she had miscarriage, she talked about the babies that she lost. Nobody said fetuses; that we said babies. When they announced a new baby, you know, from the palace in the UK, they talk about babies. And even when you talk to pro-choice people, even some ardent pro-choice advocates have said there is a death here. Even Anthony Kennedy said that one of his rulings, that we have to acknowledge that there's a death, like a human death here when there's an abortion, that there's life in the womb, that is a person. And I think science is kind of caught up with, I think, our theological beliefs. But asking yourself, is this a person? And if so, what rights do they have? And I think we should apply that across society, that if a person has full dignity, then what is my responsibility to care for them, to speak up for their welfare when they're being assaulted?
Okay, so Dan, you are the Vice President of Communications for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. You're the author of several books. You're the pastor of a church. You're a husband and a dad. What would be your word of encouragement today to people who are just out there trying to live life, and yet there are these large pressing conversations that that people feel like they need to be engaged in?
Well, first of all, I would say look around and see what influence you have in your world, and what opportunity you have to speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. I would also say we practice the idea of human dignity and in simple ways every day. I think of when the religious leaders asked Jesus, when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself. And the religious leaders asked him, who is my neighbor? And they weren't asking because they were curious. They were asking because they were looking for loopholes to that commandment. And Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan. He basically said, your neighbor is that person that you're most likely to pass by. Your neighbor is the person that you're most likely to not consider human. The people you don't like, the people groups you don't like, the people you vehemently disagree with, the people that we might consider disposable, those are our neighbors. And if you really believe that every person is created in the image of God, that we have to assign them dignity and worth and give them and value. And I think it changes the way we interact with just ordinary people, even the way we act on social media, that person I'm arguing with, it's good to have robust debates, but he is a person. She is a person created in the image of God. They're not avatars. They're not arguments. And also the way we consider each other, that we're not the sum total of our desires, where our identity is not found in our struggles or our choices, but is our identity is found in the fact that we are created in the image of God. And if you're Christian, that you're a child of God and daughter, son of the King.
All right. So before we let you go, because I always like to celebrate what you guys are doing at the ERLC, what's exciting you right now about what's happening at the ERLC?
Well, I'm excited about a few things. One, I'm really excited about our national conference that's coming up in October in Texas.
And anybody can come, right?
Anybody can come. Registration is open. We're talking about the family and, you know, the complex struggles and troubles that families face, whether economic challenges or just broken families or just some of the pressures on families today. And so we really want to help pastors and church leaders minister to families and also see our family as part of the larger family of God.
No, and I love that this is about cross-centered parenting, like that my family should be cross-shaped.
Yes.
Absolutely. Which I'm guessing means it's the vertical love of God translated horizontally here among us.
Yeah. And as the gospel works itself out in our families, you know, I think, you know, this cycle of repentance and forgiveness is so important in families, that that's how relationships work, that we are constantly repenting of our sins against our family members or wives or kids. And we're constantly forgiving our family members for things that they sins they've committed against us. And this the whole cycle of repentance and forgiveness is so essential, I think.
Okay, so will you come back in a couple weeks and talk with us about the book?
I absolutely will.
Because we don't have time to do that today, but it's The Dignity Revolution. It comes out next week. Folks could go ahead and pre-order it if they wanted to.
They absolutely can pre-order. If people pre-order it, I will not stop them from doing that.
That's good. You're free. You're free to pre-order.
Yes.
Okay, friends, we got to take a quick break, but next up, I'm going to be talking with Matt Sharp. He is an attorney with the Alliance Defending Freedom. And he and I are going to talk about some of the challenges that that Christians face across the country, and then how those challenges can be answered. And there are actually things that you can do. There are ways that you can personally engage if there are challenges to religious liberty arising in your own community. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
Keep fighting the good fight. Never give up. Never keep letting your light shine.
Only hot as long as you live. 'Cause I'm never gonna leave. Back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Privileged to be joined today by Matt Sharp. Matt serves as senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, where he directs the Center for Legislative Advocacy. Matt, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for having me.
So let's take the two words, legislative and advocacy. Okay, so when you're talking about legislative advocacy, are you talking about the state level? Are you talking about the national level? Help people understand where this advocacy is taking place.
Yeah, it's all of the above. ADF has a unique expertise when it comes to issues of free speech and religious liberty and life and things like that. And so quite often we get requests from policy groups, from legislators, from others to draw on that expertise and say, when we are crafting legislation, can you take a look at this? Can you provide us feedback? Can you help us know if this is complying with the law, you know, what it said, what the recent recent Supreme Court cases said on this particular issue. So it's really just leveraging our expertise to help make laws that are constitutionally compliant but that advance religious liberty and life.
Okay, so that's really helpful. So imagine I'm a listener in Minnesota. Hello, everybody in Minnesota. Or I'm a listener in Iowa or Idaho or Wisconsin or Michigan, I mean, or Connecticut, on and on and on. North and South Dakota, I have not forgotten about you. Kansas. I know you're all out there. Okay, so I'm in one of those states, and we're wondering in our local community and therefore at the state level how a particular Supreme Court decision that maybe is different than the way things go in our neck of the woods. Can we call and get your help being sure that what we're proposing is going to work?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the more common things we do is that we'll get a request to look over a piece of legislation, or even a local town council will reach out to us and say, we're considering this. Is this legally compliant? Or we've also had people reach out and say, my town council or my state legislature is pushing this bill. We think it's bad. Can you take a look at it? And so we'll weigh in and say, no, this does not comply with the Supreme Court's case. This is going to infringe free speech. This is going to infringe religious liberty. And so it's providing guidance so that the laws being passed are advancing religious freedom, advancing those first principles, or helping them take a step back and say, wait a second, this is not the right way to approach this. This is actually going to cause harm to religious liberty in your state or city.
Okay, now give us an example. Tell us a story.
Great example is one we're actually dealing with. I had a call about it when I was driving up today. California is trying to pass a law, as they often do, that is going to hurt religious liberty. They're trying to ban counseling. They call it conversion therapy, but it's really a counselor sitting down and talking with somebody who's struggling with same-sex attraction.
And so doesn't want it.
That's right.
Like, I think that this is an important part of this. You know, this is about people who are seeking counseling because they don't want to be feeling what they're feeling or desiring what they're desiring.
Yep.
So, okay.
That's exactly right. So, married mother of three walks into her counselor and says, I'm experiencing attraction to a close female friend, but I love my husband. I love my kids. Help me address this. Help me overcome this. Well, California is saying you can't provide that anymore, counselor. It is off limits for you to help that married mother of three achieve her counseling goals. So we've weighed in and we've written legal memos saying this violates the free speech of the counselor, this violates the free religion of the woman seeking this help, and showing legislators why this is problematic. Unfortunately, they haven't listened so far, but in other places we've seen legislators take that into consideration and say, wait a second, if this is going to get us sued, maybe we need to step back and pursue some other legislation.
So the issue in California, I mean, when we talk about trends, when we talk about things to keep an eye on, things to anticipate, the legislation in California is interesting. Are there other examples across the country where you're sort of seeing signs of change on the horizon?
Yeah. Another great example is in Massachusetts. They've got a bill that they are proudly proclaiming sort of the anti-masterpiece Jack Phillips bill, and it says that a business owner cannot assert their First Amendment rights, their right to free exercise of religion, in a defense of a lawsuit. Well, that's exactly what the Supreme Court ruled on for Jack and said, hey, you guys are showing hostility towards his religious beliefs. That's not okay. And now Massachusetts is saying, well, we actually think that is okay, and we want to take away his religious freedom as a business owner. And they're proudly proclaiming this as sort of a way to push back against the activist Supreme Court. But it shows this trend of efforts to strip away any element of religious liberty simply because a person opens up their business, because they start selling cakes or go into the craft business like Hobby Lobby. And I think it's part of this larger trend of what can we do to strip away religious liberty and confine it to individuals in their homes or in their churches and nowhere outside of that.
Okay, friends, let me remind you that my conversation partner today is Matt Sharp. He is with the Alliance Defending Freedom. You can find information about what we're talking about today at adflegal.org. That ADF stands for Alliance Defending Freedom, legal.org. So, Matt, just to remind listeners, so the Masterpiece Cake or Masterpiece Cake Shop case, the Jack Phillips case that you're referring to, I think that after the decision of the Supreme Court, which upheld Jack's right to not bake a cake, contrary to his sincerely held religious beliefs, I think that the criticism has been that the decision of the court was very narrow. It was on a very narrow issue. Are you seeing, in addition to the Massachusetts case, are you seeing evidence that other small business owners across the country who are people of religious conviction are continuing to experience the kind of things that Jack experienced?
Unfortunately, yes. We've seen situations from a homeless shelter for women being forced to admit a man. And this is a battered women's shelter. And as the guy was saying, I want to come in. And they said, no, we're trying to protect women. And this is our religious belief about the best environment for women. And so circumstances like that. And I think this is going to continue. They're going to look for ways to go after businesses that have these deeply held religious beliefs about marriage, about family. I think we're particularly seeing it with adoption agencies. I think a lot of people are familiar with Philadelphia, where they went after the faith-based agencies and said, you can't contract. You can't help us place kids in forever homes because of your particular beliefs about marriage and family. And so I do think these attacks are going to grow, and that's why it's more important than ever not just to have good legal wins, but also to make sure that the laws being passed are protective of religious liberty.
Okay, so let's I got a phone call the other day from a pastor in St. Louis, and his mother lives in a senior living facility that is currently being sued by two women who are legally married. But the facility does not recognize marriage as outside the bounds of one man and one woman. However, I think it's unclear whether or not they have sufficiently expressed that in, let's say, their online presence and in their presentation of what they do and who they are. So I know that going back a few years, I mean, I remember attorneys counseling churches and everybody else following the Supreme Court's decision in Obergefell that you really need to make your position clear. You need to be very clear about your position. So can you help people understand who are, maybe they're on the local board of their church, or they're on the local board of a senior living facility or whatever. Can you help them understand the kinds of steps they should take? Again, we're not giving legal advice here on the radio. I think everybody knows that. But the kinds of steps, the documents they should look at, the things that they should be sure are clear in order to substantiate that this is a sincerely held religious belief.
Yeah. you hit the keywords, the sincerely held. What courts look to a lot of times is, what evidence is there that this is a sincere belief and not just something you're making up because you don't like these people or you're trying to get out of liability or something like that. And so when you've got a business, and let's take like a photographer, and on their website they talk about their Christian faith and how they love celebrating the beauty of God's plan for marriage and every package that they do for a couple that's seeking out their services, and where they talk about the driving principles of, you know, we seek to glorify God through my photography and things like that, it becomes a lot harder for a court or government official to question the sincerity of their religious belief when you've got it plastered on your website and when it's in your contracts and things like that. And I think it just demonstrates, not just to courts, but even to the world, that our faith is integral to every part of what we do. We don't separate it out. We don't check it at the church doors or leave it at home when we head into the office, but it influences everything we do. I think it's Chick-fil-A that is part of their sort of core driving principles. Truett Cathy has it in there, to glorify God through all that we do. And I love that there's businesses like them, like Hobby Lobby and others, that put it right up front. We exist first and foremost to glorify God. And so when businesses put that out publicly, I think it helps demonstrate to the world, this is a sincere belief and it's going to determine what we do in business decisions.
So we recently got to talk to David Green here on Connecting Faith, and he's written a book about he and his wife's legacy. He's at that stage of life, right, where he's beginning to reflect and think about. And it's so dear that, you know, obviously they are people of extraordinary financial means. But what matters to him is that they have really, God has really allowed them to be used as witnesses in the world. But he seems, the most important witness you can tell for him is this generational legacy of faith. He's just, it's just precious. And so, you know, he would be the kind of person, you're not going to question whether or not these are sincerely held religious beliefs. This is who this man is to the core. Mm-hmm. So talk with us a little bit about, I would look at David Green and say, okay, I'm picking that client. Like, that's the case I'm going to pick, because you can drill down as far as you want and you are not going to find anything but authentic Christianity. Talk with us about that.
Yeah, I think it's one thing we've been incredibly blessed to be able to represent courageous men and women who exemplify that. You look at Jack Phillips. You look at Baronel Stutzman, the florist from Washington State. You look at a lot of the others we've represented in the challenges to the contraceptive mandate, like Hobby Lobby. And so we were involved in that case with a family, Mennonite family from Pennsylvania, that had deeply held beliefs about that. And you just see how it is core to who they are. And it's so beautiful. Baronel, who I've been able to travel with a lot, you hear her talk about her relationship with Rob Ingersoll, the individual that's suing her. And she talks of a place of love for him. Like, he was my friend. He is my friend. And I loved being able to work with him and create with him. But when the time came, I had to tell him I could not do these flowers, this custom arrangement for his wedding. And so you see the heartache as well. And I think that shows that for her, she loves him. But if you ask her this, she loves God more. And at the end of the day, she's got to be faithful to those convictions God has placed in her when it comes to the sanctity of marriage. And I think that's the beautiful part of all of this, is these are Americans that love their country, that love their fellow man, but that love God more and are just wanting to have the freedom to continue to live out that faith, both in their private lives, but also in their work.
All right, friends, my conversation partner is Matt Sharp. We are talking about religious liberty, and we are talking about advocacy at the legislative level. We're talking about policy. We're talking about courage. We're talking about faith. So we're going to continue this conversation right after the break. This is Connecting Faith, and I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey, friends. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined today by Matt Sharp. Matt serves as senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, where he directs the Center for Legislative Advocacy. So we actually started our conversation, Matt, on the subject of you know, sort of where does this happen? But let's take the word advocacy and let's talk about how this happens. What, from your viewpoint, is sort of the scope of advocacy when it comes to these concerns and issues?
I think there's two components of it. The first is the legal component. It is, what does the law say on this? Why is this particular bill you're proposing unconstitutional? Why does it infringe religious liberty? Or the other side would be, why does this bill conform to constitutional protections? And so I think there's a very important part of that of we provide legal expertise. We can tell them the ins and outs and the nuances of what the First Amendment requires and things like that. But I would say an even more important component of advocacy is the storytelling part. We have to be able to communicate why these laws are good or bad and who they hurt or harm. And I think one of the most effective things we've seen is being able to travel to states with our clients like Jack Phillips, like Baronelle Stutzman and others, and put a human face on the laws they're trying to pass. So we've traveled, for example, last year we were in Nebraska, and they were proposing a law identical to the one in Colorado that was used to go after Jack Phillips. And it was gaining momentum, and we showed up at the legislature.
So just to tell people, that's a piece of civil rights legislation.
That's right.
Okay.
It's a law that essentially says you can't discriminate against someone based upon their sexual orientation when it comes to your business practices and things like that, which Jack Phillips would say, yeah, anybody's welcome to my shop, but there's certain lines I can't cross. So we show up in Nebraska, and he sits before this legislature and tells a story and says, if you pass this law, you're going to see a lot more people like me being harmed, being run out of business, losing 40% of their business and having to lay off employees. Is that what you want? Because that's what these laws are used to do. The law died. And it was truly due to being able to present Jack's story, to let the legislators put a human face with what they're trying to do. And I think that is a key part of advocacy, is the more we can show these stories of who's impacted, it really does change hearts and minds.
So let's talk about kids in schools. We want to tell stories. Let's talk about, because I think that this gender confusion, sexual identity confusion, and then the introduction of SOGI laws, sexual orientation, gender identity laws, on the civil rights or discrimination front, whichever language mm-hmm. people want to use to describe that. When we have a child who is presenting as a gender other than their biological sex, and we have all become convinced somehow that that child's opportunity to express themselves is more important than every other child in that school, every other child in that Boy Scout troop, every other child, go down the list of institutions that have been willing to conform themselves to the dysphoria of an individual. Help us tell a different story about the harm done to every other kid.
Yeah. First and foremost is the privacy violations. One of the stories that hit me, we were representing some young girls in Illinois in a lawsuit up there, and one of them described how when the school made a decision to start allowing a boy that claimed to be a girl to use the girls' locker room, she would show up at school and they had gym class, and rather than being able to change in the locker room, she now wore her gym clothes underneath her street clothes. And so when gym time would come, she'd take off her outerwear, go into gym class, do all the exercises and come back. And rather than changing out of those sweaty clothes, she put her street clothes back on and stayed in those dirty, sweaty clothes the rest of the day because she was so afraid of being seen by this boy. Where are her rights? Where's her dignity? Where's her right to privacy and to be able to just live a normal female experience like everyone else? Another one, a young girl in Connecticut and had been training for track meet all of these years, was sort of one of the top ones in the state. Well, all of a sudden, two boys in Connecticut began identifying as female, and that just this few months ago at the state track meet, they took first and second spot, including setting a new quote-unquote girls record for track meet. And I look at this young girl that had been trying all of her life and using her God-given talents, and now because some boy claimed to be a girl, she lost that spot at the top. What is that going to impact on scholarships and college opportunities and things like that? That's the cost of this ideology being pushed upon students, that it does impact so many young girls and boys as well across the country.
So I'm curious to know, in your advocacy on this particular issue, I mean, are the feminists right there with you? Because this seems like something that they should be championing.
Yeah, it's been surprising. We've had a group, I think it's the Women's Liberation Front, that's been really active in this. Now, I don't agree with them on most issues, but they recognize that all of the things that they've been fighting for decades.
Like Title IX.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking Title IX's going down with this.
It absolutely is, because everything that says, oh, you can have separate athletics teams and scholarships, now they're saying, well, you got to allow a guy to have that. And so they're screaming bloody murder over it, as they should, because this is what they fought for, that of equal opportunities, and now even that's being taken away, and some guy can come in and take advantage of those opportunities.
Well, I think it's important for listeners to know, like, you and I, neither one, have any heart nor desire to denigrate in any way young people who are genuinely gender dysphoric and really struggling. And for their families, this is traumatic. But I also think it's important for listeners to know that today, all a student has to do is say that they're identifying as a different gender. There doesn't actually have to be any involvement beyond the student's own self-declaration. Am I right?
That's absolutely right.
So there's not, you know, it's not as if this is a person who's necessarily going through some kind of transition through hormone treatments, you know, or, you know, in my view, something as destructive as surgery. But literally, a boy who is maybe third or fourth on the boys' track team can come in and self-identify as a girl and be number one in the state overnight.
That's right.
Okay, that just seems fundamentally unfair. So I don't know if fundamental fairness is in the Constitution, but I feel like it should be.
Yeah, that's what so many of these things were designed to do with Title IX and everything else was – it's more fair to have guys compete against guys and girls compete against girls. It's more fair to have girls' locker rooms and guys' locker rooms as long as they're, you know, comparable facilities and things like that. And that was the premise of it, but not to strip away privacy and these other rights.
So let's talk about accommodation and reasonable accommodation, because I think that there would be people who would immediately say, well, can't that young person just have their own changing facility? Why has that not been an acceptable solution to this problem?
Well, I think it's because this is not about accommodation. You look at other contexts. If you've got a young girl that wears a head covering, you allow exceptions and accommodations from a school dress code that says you can't wear hats. Same thing if you've got a student that uses a wheelchair. What do? You build ramps. You rearrange their classes so that they're on ground level. We've always shown compassion and accommodation. When we offered this to students struggling with gender confusion, it's not acceptable. And that shows this is not about accommodation. This is about forcing an ideology on everyone else. And we see it with their demands. You must use a pronoun I choose, so you're compelling other people what to say. We're seeing it with them saying you can't even tell parents if a child is struggling with this because the child gets to decide when to out themselves to their parents. Well, that's taking away the right of parents to be involved in what's going on with their kids. So this is about pushing an ideology, not about ensuring that kids have accommodations, which we are more than supportive of. We think that's a vital thing to do, but not to force this on others in a way that violates their rights.
Okay, friends, just to remind you one more time, my guest this afternoon is Matt Sharp. He serves as senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom. He directs the Center for Legislative Advocacy. You've learned from our conversation that he has the opportunity to travel around the country and present information to state legislators across the country, you know, related to Supreme Court decisions and related to how religious liberty and free speech conversations around the country could come to impact them in their particular state. And so when we talk about the formulation of legislation and the formulation of policy, what do you see as the biggest challenges?
I think number one is dispelling myths and bad information about a lot of these. When you see bills that protect religious freedom, that ensure that nonprofits and small business owners and others can operate according to their beliefs, a lot of times it's immediately, oh, this is going to open the floodgates to all these terrible things. Well, they don't, because we've seen a lot of states pass them, and there has not been any economic downside or anything like that, just the opposite. When you encourage and protect the freedom of business owners and nonprofits to operate consistent with their beliefs, that's attractive to a business. I want to go to a state where the government's not micromanaging every aspect. So a big part is dispelling those myths, dispelling those inaccuracies. But then the second part is, I think, again, goes back to providing the compelling stories. Even legislators want somebody to champion. They want a little guy to say, this is why I came into government business, to protect the little guy from intrusive government. And so if we can help demonstrate who they're protecting, who this is going to help in their state and in their constituencies, I think that's a big part of helping them make the right decisions when it comes to legislation.
So let me ask one additional question, Matt, and this may be completely out of the blue. So I've recently heard that we have one member of Congress who is who's Muslim. He's not going to run for re-election. Instead, in his state, I think he's going to run for attorney general. I think that's the latest news. Talk with me about understanding that conversation related to the foundational principles of who we are as a people and the reality that we have a very pluralistic populace, but we also have that reflected in legislatures both at the state and national level.
Yeah. I think the wisdom of our founding fathers is demonstrated in circumstances like this. Obviously, when America was founded, we were a very predominantly Christian nation. But even then, they knew the importance of religious pluralism and laws that protect everybody equally. And it's a beautiful vision that we're still seeing today, and we're seeing how those principles apply. And I think what they recognized is we want everyone to be free to live out their conscience, but there are also going to be uniform laws that we're all subject to, that regardless of what your religious background is, there has to be certain core principles and certain laws that unite us as America, that set us apart as Americans from everywhere else in the world. And they found that balance. And you see things from, you know, the accommodations for conscientious objectors in war, right? Principle is everyone needs to fight to defend America. But we recognize that there's going to be a few individuals of different religious faiths that can't do that, that can't pick up arms. We can accommodate them while still having that unifying principle of take up your arms to defend your country. And I think we're going to see that principle continue to be played again and again of anyone is welcome to serve in our country. We don't care what your religious belief or your background is. But at the same time, you have to embody those shared principles that make us American. And I think that's what we see in a lot of places like this.
So do you have time for one more question?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I want you to help me imagine for a moment that my little school board or my little, I don't know, might even be lower than the school board, whatever. We get a letter from an organization that says we're doing things that are bad and they're going to sue us. So I'm thinking here a letter from the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Let's just say, let's just imagine that. What do I do and what do I not do?
The advice I give to school boards is the same thing I give to my kids when they head off to school. Stand up to bullies. And these organizations come in and they make threats and, oh, you have to stop this and you have to stop that. It's a bully that is pushing their agenda and their ideology on local schools. And so often we see that the things that they say are just simply inaccurate and are nowhere required in our Constitution and law. Their idea of, you know, students should have minimal religious freedom protections and teachers have to check their faith at the door is just wrong. So what I encourage them to do, reach out to us. Let us help walk you through the scenario. Explain what your rights are, what your obligations are as school officials, and help you to stand up to groups like Freedom From Religion, because you do not have to compromise those First Amendment freedoms for your students or your teachers when it comes to the school day. But you do have to stand up to bullies, because otherwise they just plow through you and get their way.
All right, friends, that's Matt Sharp. He is from ADF. You can find them at adflegal.org. That's Alliance Defending Freedom, legal.org. Matt, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, friends, stick with me. This is Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be back to make the connecting point. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. All right, so what I want to talk about here in our connecting point today is the value of religious freedom. So we've had this conversation with Matt Sharp. We have explored some of the challenges and concerns that folks are facing across the country and how in your own local community and in your state legislature and certainly at the national level, we have the opportunity to encourage and develop and enforce policies and laws that would actually support the free expression of religion here in the United States. So what I want to do here in the closing segment today is just talk with you about the reality of our brothers and sisters in China, because their experience is just completely different right now than our own. So you may say to yourself, well, their big problem is that the Constitution of China doesn't support religious liberty or doesn't guarantee it. Well, in fact, that's not true. The Constitution in China actually promises religious freedom. But the experience of Christians in China is something that I'd like to bring you up to speed on. So this is actually from the Associated Press, posted today. The article headline is "For God or Party: China's Christians Face Test of Faith." So this is the story of a 62-year-old Chinese shopkeeper who waited his entire adult life to see the dream of getting to build a church. And he built this brick building on his own property. It has a sunny courtyard, a very spacious room that, you know, up to 200 people could gather in. But in March, a dozen police officers and the officials from the local province of Henan showed up at the church on his property and made the frightened congregants disperse. They ordered that the cross and a painting of the Last Supper and a Bible verse in calligraphy be taken down. And they demanded that all of the quote-unquote worship services, which they didn't regard as worship services, stop until every person, along with the church itself, were registered with the government. So they want to register individual Christians, and they want every single place where worship is going to take place to be registered with the government. And so all of this took place without warning. And I think that we have to remember that the experience of the free expression of religion that we have here in the United States, just because it's guaranteed in the Constitution, if you and I aren't actually exercising it, and then when it is threatened or challenged, if we aren't taking a stand for it, we are in an equally tenuous position. So this crackdown on Christianity is part of a broader push by the Xi government to, it's called sinicize all of the nation's religions by infusing them with Chinese characteristics. Now, you and I would call that probably synthesizing other things into the Christian faith. So they want even at Christian worship services, they want people to be making loyalty pledges to the Communist Party, which you and I can just imagine. That's just not going to happen. Christians just aren't going to do that. They are asking that Islamic crescents and domes be stripped from mosques. And they have launched a campaign to, quote unquote, re-educate tens of thousands of Uyghur Muslims. The Tibetan children have been moved out of Buddhist temples into government schools. They are banned from religious activities during their summer holidays. And so just on and on and on. So there is an actual 5-year plan in place by the Xi government to sinicize Christianity in particular. And they have new rules regarding all kinds of things related to what Christians can and cannot do, and to Christian house churches. Okay, so they've actually shut down hundreds of house churches across China. Now, why am I telling you all this? I want you to imagine for a moment that just because the Constitution says that you and I have the right to freely express religion, if in fact the government were to decide otherwise, and you say, well, in America, we are the government, right? Well, only insofar as members of our government and people who are actually making decisions are upholding what you and I all value as freedom of religion, as long as we are defining it in that way. So I want to encourage you to think about this. I want you to think about the fact that if you're not freely exercising your religion, if you have bought into the lie that religion is a private affair, should be privatized, should be something that you don't do in public, certainly not something you talk about in the public square of ideas and the free exchange of ideas in your community, then you're kind of buying into the reduction of the full freedom of religion and its free expression in all sectors of society to the freedom of worship, and that is a limited experience in a confined space that is registered with the government in some way, shape, or form, here in America, mostly as nonprofit organizations. So when you read further in the AP article today, you are going to see that the Chinese leaders view Christians as posing a threat to the communist regime. They are suspicious of a political challenge arising from Christianity. Now, that is an interesting thing to consider. And first of all, I didn't even know that we have like all kinds of scholars in America on the subject of Christianity in China, which that's cool. Anyway, there's a professor at Duke University who specializes in this. And this professor says that under President Xi, the fear of Western infiltration has actually intensified and gains this prominence That then rises to a concern about the growing trend of people becoming Christians and forming these house churches and expressing these religious convictions, not just in the context of worship services, but throughout their whole lives. Now, you and I know that that is what we mean when we talk about religious conscience and we talk about religious expression. We're talking about being Christians all the time in every place. Regardless of the circumstance, we are going to continue to not only uphold the name of Jesus, but live as commanded by Christ to live. So we're going to tell the truth, even when it's uncomfortable. We are going to love, even when the world's response might be hatred. We are going to continue to pray in the name of Jesus, even if somebody tells us to stop. And we're going to continue sharing the name of Jesus. Now here you're thinking to yourselves, hey, I've heard a story about this before in the Bible. Well, that's exactly right. The challenge that Christians face in terms of governments telling them to stop talking about Jesus, this is a challenge that we have faced literally since the first generation of Christianity. So I bring this up today, first of all, so that we can be praying for our brothers and sisters in Christ in China. Like, let us not forget that that we have brothers and sisters in every nation under heaven. Some of them are in places where the information about their situation, you know, gets out, and we know what they're suffering, and we know what they're experiencing, and so we can pray for them ardently by name, by location. Let's be praying specifically for the church that meets in this shopkeeper's house. And let's be praying for the Christians in the Henan province of China. And let's be praying for other persecuted religious minorities in China as well, who are also targeted by this plan to sinicize religious believers in the nation of China. Let's pray for the wife of one pastor who is now under house arrest. Let's pray for a government that says that their people have religious freedom, but who actually have no freedom at all. And let's be praying for the fact that these people are paying the price. There is a cost. There is a cost to being a disciple of Jesus. And you may say that here in your experience in the American culture or over the border in Canada, where those of you are listening to us today as well, you may say to yourself, well, the cost here is pretty low. And that is true. But the cost is very high in other places. So just want to encourage you today to be considering the circumstance of our brothers and sisters around the world, even as you pray the news in relationship to specifically these churches in China. So what does that mean that you and I can do today? Well, first of all, I'm going to encourage you to pray. Second of all, I'm going to encourage you to actually get out there into the marketplace of ideas in your own community and freely express your faith. I mean, not in a way that is, you know, getting in the face of other people and intentionally being obnoxious. Please don't do that. But I do want us to be being Christians in reality in every circumstance of life. So as your kids are going back to school, maybe there's a group of moms that wants to get out and actually prayer walk the campuses. Like, you could, you know, you can walk around the block and pray for what's happening inside that public school. Maybe you say to yourself, well, you know what, my kids are all grown and I don't, I'm not doing that right now. I'm past that stage. You know what? A walk outside in your neighborhood praying for kids as they are going to school is not a bad idea either. So let's just freely express our faith in order that those around us and those in authority over us, you know, positions of power in the government, will be reminded that the free expression of religion here in the United States of America is the free expression in every arena of life, and that we are here to serve our neighbors, even as we serve our God. And so that would be my other encouragement to you today, to be seeking out, looking for, anticipating that God would have set divine appointments for you today where you're going to be able to bear positive public witness about who he is, his nature and character, his desire to be positively influencing, bringing good into the lives of others. All right, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. That is all the time that we have today. Be sure and share today's show with someone else by going to myfaithradio.com, signing up for the podcast, sharing it on your social media. I am on Twitter at Carmen LaBerge. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.